Hey, y'all. My name is Sherry Gallier, and I am an alcoholic. And gee, that's so funny. I had page 29 marked because I usually like to read that to, you know, center myself and tell you what I would like to accomplish with my talk. And a very good friend of mine always who speaks, she does a whole lot of speaking all over the place. She always says, Sherry, when you speak, take a moment to breathe God in and breathe Sherry out. I did that. But first, I'd like to ask, thanks, Sam. Thank you so much for asking me up here. It's always my privilege to be able to come and represent Alcoholics Anonymous. I am a very grateful member of AA, and I will start in the traditional way and tell you that my sobriety date is November 20th, 2007. I have a home group, which actually meets on Sunday from 5 to 6. It's the Keystone Group to Chippenham Hospital in Richmond. I have a sponsor I left a message for this morning and spoke to her yesterday, and I do sponsor other women, and it's through those women that I learn, like, absolutely the most about alcoholics, alcoholism, and about myself and how God works. So it's I'm really grateful the way the universe puts those people in my life. Now, you know, I always have to go back and tell you what it was like and what happened and, of course, what it's like now. And I like to spend a lot of time with, you know, what happened and what it's like now. But since I had a whole lot of years of drinking, a lot of it comes out with, you know, how I got to the point where I found AA. And one of the things I do is I can't see your clock, so I always take my little wristwatch off. And I get this from my dad. You'll hear my story. My father was a Baptist minister my whole life. And when he was in the pulpit, he was very considerate of his parishioners. And he would always take off his watch and set it right up here so he could keep an eye and make sure that he was done by 5 minutes to 12 on Sunday. And trust me, we were all like, okay. I would be like, Daddy, come on now. You're running a little late. But so, let's see. I was born September 26, 1968, in Richmond, and I was adopted. I do not know anything about my biological family. I don't know if I have brothers and sisters. I don't know, you know, what the situation was. But I do know that I came to a home of two very loving parents. And I've always considered the people that raised me as my mom and dad. You know, I mean, I'm a typical alcoholic. I never felt like I fit in. I had all those fears of abandonment and, you know, I just never felt like I belonged. I never felt that niche. And I always attributed it to being adopted. Because my mom and dad made it very clear. They didn't hide it from me. They made it very clear that, you know, I was special. I was a special child, you know. God, very Christian family, you know. God made, you know, brought you to us, and we love you. And your mom loved you enough that you could come and be with us. So I was brought up in a home of love, but that never really compensated for that emptiness. I mean, even really, really young, I just always wanted to go home, and I would be sitting in my bedroom. I don't have to describe it because I know many of you all know that feeling. And, you know, I was raised with a lot of morals and values and structures. My father was not only a Baptist minister, he was also a high school history teacher. He was the department chairman. And my mother, until she opened her own business, was the librarian in my elementary school. So I had some built-in structure, and I had a lot of expectations as far as education goes. And I was a liar from the very beginning. I mean, I didn't like school, really, because it interrupted stuff I wanted to do. And I didn't really have any reason to lie. And I never had anybody, like, showing me what that was. And I don't understand. You know, my parents weren't, like, lying to each other. They were, you know, a happily married couple. So I don't know where I got that from. Maybe the soap operas I was sneaking around and watching. I don't know. But I remember very vividly the first lie I told. And it was straight to get my way. That selfishness, you know, I was acting and thinking alcoholically long before I even knew what it was. Because there was no alcohol in my home. There was, you know, no deviant behavior. I mean, it was just a really good place to be a kid. So, you know, I started acting out a little bit. Not bad, you know. And when I was 6, going on 7, I was diagnosed. I had issues with my thyroid, which was very unusual in a child like that. And I remember getting really, really bad, debilitating headaches. And so, because maybe my parents weren't alcoholics, my mother always kind of taught me, here, if you feel bad, Sherry, here, take this pill. You know, oh, you don't feel so well? Here, we'll take this, just put this under your tongue. I found out later I was taking a prescribed narcotic at 7, and they kept it in the nurse's office. So even when I didn't have a headache, I was, like, seeking out the nurse's office to get out of taking a test. And I just remember that, you know, warm, kind of, you know, the clinic was, like, dark, and I remember the bed was, it was plastic, but it was kind of cool, and I was like, oh, I don't feel like doing this. I'm going up and see the nurse, you know. So I was doing that kind of, let's take this to get out of myself really early, and I didn't even know what I was doing. So I did okay in school, you know. I didn't try very hard. I've never been a real go-getter. You know, I do just enough to get by. And I guess, you know, I started getting a little crazy in middle school, you know, smoking the cigarettes, hanging out with the wrong crowd, you know, looking at boys. I don't know. And the more I wanted to rebel, the tighter my mom was a disciplinarian. I have to make this clear from the very beginning, because my dad was the type of person that says, Sherry, if you're going to make a mistake, you're going to learn from your own mistakes. I'm not going to try and correct you. I believe that you should have your own experience. And, of course, I love that. And then I could get away with murder. But my mom, not so much. She was like, okay, you're going to do this. You're grounded. We're going to blah, 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 blah. And the more that happened, the more I just went a little nuts. So I do real poorly in school. I don't remember my first drunk, actually. I mean, I remember being fascinated. Somebody had given my parents a bottle of wine for some kind of holiday, and it sat in the bottom of our pantry for I don't know how long. And I was like, I'm going to try that. Because, you know, I was watching soap operas. I was fascinated with those people with their little highballs and, you know, their nice dresses and stuff. And they were always drinking cocktails. And so I said, I'm going to try this. Well, I have a corkscrew. Of course, I didn't even know what a corkscrew was. So I ended up, like, pushing the cork into the wine, you know. And I take a big swig. And it was so old, it was vinegar. So I remember getting, like, this mouthful of vinegar and this mouthful of cork and going, oh, you know, this is just disgusting. But it didn't stop me from trying it again, because it was like, that's what my parents said, don't do. So that's exactly what I was going to do. So, you know, nipping at the my friend's parents' liquor cabinet. But I do remember the first time I really drank alcoholically. I was 15 and on a cruise ship. And by this time, my mom had opened her own business, and it was a tour business. And it started through the church. She had started taking, people from the church on these places, these trips. My parents loved to travel. And it was so successful, she decided to go into business. And so that also meant my mom was gone a lot. So I had a lot of unsupervised time. And so we took this cruise to Alaska. And there's no drinking age on a cruise ship. If you could order the drink and, you know, make eye contact with the bartender, you could have whatever you wanted. And not only could you have whatever you wanted, you could charge it to the room. So I didn't need any money. So I got drunk a lot on that cruise, and it wasn't so much, I mean, I remember the feeling, you know, that loose and free and feeling, but I remember more feeling accepted by people my own age that I didn't even know, feeling comfortable, you know, in my own skin. That just kind of elusive feeling. But then they got the bill. And they saw all these, like, mixed drinks. Like, I don't remember whether they actually named the drink or whether it would just said bar, 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 bar. And I convinced my mom that they were all virgins, but they had to charge the full price because it was the cruise. I don't know whether she believed me or not. Really didn't matter. They were just mad about the money. But that kind of, you know, that opened up another door. So, you know, in high school, I went back to high school, and, again, just the drinking, the hanging out, the lack of motivation. I never knew what I wanted to do. I never had, like, a career goal. You know, when I was, like, in the third or fourth grade, I wanted to be a jockey because I love horses. But when I got over, like, 4'10", you know, my dream was shot. So I never had another career choice after that because I was mad that God made me grow bigger than 4'10". And so I was aimless. I was very aimless. And I was still just looking for that place to fit in. You know, and I found it. You know, I found it with the people that were doing things that I was not raised to participate in. And I found it very appealing, and it was exhilarating. You know, I was stealing, I was lying, I was drinking, I was doing other stuff, and the gap between my parents and I got wider and wider. I don't have any brothers or sisters, and both of my parents' sides of the family are very small. My mom had one sister. My dad had one brother. They had their spouses, and then I had a couple cousins. So my, like, immediate family was very small. So I always, you know, reached outward. I was always, you know, looking and seeking attention outside of that. Plus, my parents were pretty old when, not old, older than I am now, but my dad was, like, 39, and my mom was 36 when I was born. So it kind of pushed me into another generation. They were raised in the Depression, and that those kind of, you know, influences that my peers didn't have were what I was taught. So this whole other lifestyle, this whole, you know, 1970s hippies, 1980s disco, 1980s punk, hardcore scene really appealed to my rebellious side. And then, you know, I have to talk about my family and the fact that even though I was struggling and even though I was out of control teenager, we didn't talk about it, you know. Nobody at church was supposed to know. Nobody in my family, you know, my family was supposed to know. Everything was supposed to look good on the outside, and it was not so good. So my parents were, my mom more so, were secret keepers. And I say this to lead up to the fact that when I was a junior in high school, I came home from school one day, and both of my parents were never home when I got there. And I pull up to the house, and both cars are there. And I'm like, oh, no, I'm in trouble. They're both here. They found something out. So I go inside. I'm like, oh, God, what have I done? Well, they're upstairs in my mom's bedroom. And they're like, Sherry, we need to talk to you. And I said, okay. And they're like, Your mom had breast cancer, and it has moved into her lymph nodes, and she's going to be operated on. And I'm like, oh my God. And the way my dad found out my mom was sick, my mom was misdiagnosed. Her primary care physician had put her off for almost a year because she had lumps and she kept going. And finally, after almost a year, she sought a second opinion and found out that, you know, it was cancerous, and she had gone in for some kind of procedure where she had to be sedated and could not drive. And through a miscommunication, she didn't realize that. She drove to the office, and they told her, you can't drive, May. And she's like, well, I'll call a cab. And she didn't have the money for a cab, or there was something, but she ended up having to call my father and tell him what was going on. She had gone through this alone because she didn't want anybody to feel sorry for her. And so when they sat me down, they said, your mom's sick, and she's going to go through chemo, she's going to go through radiation, but you can't tell anybody because your mom wants to keep this a secret, and we're going to respect your mother's wishes. And I was like, why? And, you know, my dad took me aside and was like, you know, your mom has a reputation to uphold in the community. You know, she has a business to run. She doesn't want her business associates to lose confidence in her, you know, and she doesn't really want anybody to feel sorry for her. And I'm like, okay, you know, and I'm so selfish and self-centered, you know, I make it about me. Oh, poor me, I can't, you know, oh, I can't tell anybody about my mom, so I think I'll just go booze it up some more with my friends. And it was pretty bad. So she goes through her treatment, and I continue, and I always say when I tell my story that our diseases paralleled. The sicker she got, the sicker I got. And we fought a lot, and mostly because she just wanted me to be okay. You know, my mom loved me a lot, and so did my dad. And her goal was to be well enough to see me graduate from high school, and she met that goal. And for some odd reason, I applied at VCU, and I got in. I don't know how, but I did. And so I went to VCU, and that was just the gateway to adulthood for me. And it wasn't about the education. Like I said, I had no goals. It was just about the party. And it became more than the drinking. You know, I was introduced to things that were not legal, and I went places that were not pretty, and I did things that I'm not proud of. And a lot of those things were illegal. I mean, throughout my progression of my alcoholism, you know, any morals or values I ever had, right out the window. You know, if you had it, I was going to steal it. If you didn't have it, you were going to take me and go and steal it. I mean, it was horrible. I don't even know where that came from. It was just that selfishness. I was just driven by what I wanted at that minute. And I didn't care about anybody else's feelings. And I did a geographic. I went to Tennessee for a little while. That didn't work. They threw me out of that. Oh, friends threw me out. The state didn't actually throw me out, but that's later. But I had to come back to Virginia. And had to come back to my parents' house, and my parents were like, okay, you're going to treatment. I'm like, treatment for what? I'm fine. I got this. I'll go back. I dropped out of school, of course. I'll go back to school. Everything will be great. And they're like, no. You know, you've stolen from us. You've lied to us. You've got weird people coming over here at all hours of the day and night. You know, we just can't have this in our house. And so they sent me to treatment, a very nice treatment center. And I think I was maybe 19, and for some reason they thought that I was still on their health insurance. So I went to this beautiful, like, indoor swimming pool, sunroom, you know, snacks in the refrigerator treatment center with my own room, my own bathroom, and smoking banana peels and, you know, hanging out after hours and skinny dipping, and I didn't care. I mean, I thought it was great because I was getting a little vacation. Well, they came to me, the staff came to me and was like, well, Miss Gal, you're being discharged. I'm like, I am? And they're like, yeah, you don't have any insurance. And I'm like, okay, great. You know, I didn't care that I just stiffed my parents for a $20,000 treatment bill that they were trying to help me. I didn't care. So I thought, oh, good, I just get to go back home. And they're like, yeah, on one condition. My parents are like, one condition, you're going to treatment. So they ended up sending me to this beautiful little place, and I say that with all sarcasm, in Cartersville called Willow Oaks. Now, this is December of 1989, and I don't know if anybody's ever gone to Willow Oaks. It's just like a big farmhouse, and even in 1989, they didn't even have trailers. It was like everybody was like in one house. So I go from cushy, you know, South Virginia, beautiful treatment center for adolescents to Willow Oaks, and not only was it that, but we got snowed in, so nobody, none of the staff could get in. So it was just a bunch of drunks and drug addicts, like, hanging out. And I met a boy, and I thought I was cured. I was like, this is what I need. I need companionship, you know? If you love me enough and I love you enough, then we can be clean together. We can not drink together. Anybody want to hesitate to guess how that worked out? Yeah, didn't work out so well. So that is, it's 1990, and of course with the disease, I just got worse. I just, you know, I drew more lines in the sand and kept stepping across them, you know, I just jumped into the ocean. And I did another geographic, and only this time, to straighten my life out, I decided to go to New Orleans, Louisiana, where all good alcoholics should go to get themselves straight. And, you know, they taught me how to drink. They taught me about the morning drink. They taught me about going across the street to the bar to get drinks while you're on break because you're so hungover from the night before, you don't know how you're going to make it to the end. You know, so they taught me, you know, how to manage my alcohol. And I thought I was doing great. So I'm not doing anything illegal. I'm paying my bills. You know, I had this awesome job. And, of course, everybody's an alcoholic, so nobody, I mean, it's like the inmates running the asylum, you know, who cares? I mean, but since everybody was doing it, it had that facade of being okay. And I fooled, and my mom was still very sick, and I went back and forth from Louisiana came back up here to Virginia a couple times while she had surgery and was in the hospital. I had this, you know, crazy boyfriend, and it was just a very insane time in my life. And I was in New Orleans, and it's November 16th, 1990, and I was at a convenience store. I was shopping for some lunch with my friend, and these two police officers came up to me, and they said, are you Sherry Gallier? And I said, yes. And I thought they were coming to question me because there had been a stabbing at my job. Great job. There had been a stabbing at my job, and I thought they were coming to question me because I was a witness. I said, yeah. They're like, you want to step outside? I'm like, oh, sure, we can talk about it outside. Well, I get outside, and there's like all these cop cars, and they're like whirling me around and pushing me up against the building and arresting me. And I'm like, what are you doing? Where am I going? And they're like, you're under arrest for a fugitive warrant from Richmond, Virginia. I'm like, what? You know, I don't know what's going on. And so I end up going to jail in Orleans Parish Prison, which is not a very nice place. And what had happened was someone I drove months and months prior had been doing some illegal things while I was driving them around in my car. Just, you know, I want them to buy me food, so yeah, I'll drive you anywhere. I didn't know what they're doing. I didn't care, you know. And they thought I was some kind of accomplice to these, you know, illegal drug sales. And I was, you know. But, you know, don't look, don't see doesn't go really far with the Commonwealth of Virginia. So my mom's sick. I come back to Richmond in handcuffs. They transported me. I ended up getting felony time for that. I ended up getting serving 14 months in the Richmond City Jail until the judge had mercy on me because of my mom's illness. And I used her illness a lot. Again, it's all about me. It's all about what I can do. It's all about what I can get from you. And so I would use her illness. Poor me, poor me, poor let me out of, you know, let me out of jail so I can help my mother die with dignity. It wasn't about that. But the judge bought it and let me out. And so I got, my mom died August 18th, 1992. And I was able to physically be there. I was not there, you know, solely because, you know, I was still doing what I was doing. But I was able to have a moment with my mom while she was in the hospital. And I asked her, I knew very little about AA. They had introduced it to me in the treatment center, but I wanted nothing to do with it because I had no intention of staying sober. None. But I knew enough that I knew that I loved my mom. And I knew that everything that my mom had done for my whole life was because she loved me. And so I went to her and I said, you know, Mom, do you forgive me for everything I've done? And she said, I do. Of course I do. You're my daughter. And that was the first time, you know, I had like this, oh my God, it's not about me, you know. She did all this stuff for me. It's not really about me. And then I brushed it off, you know. And I went and got a drink. But I was actually there when, you know, she died in her home. She had come home for hospice, and so I was there when she passed. But after that, took the gloves off. I went, you know, right back out there. I ignored the fact that my father was grieving, that he had lost his companion, his mate, his love of his life. He not only lost her, but he lost his only daughter, because at that point, the alcoholism, it wasn't me that you saw. It was just a shell of me. And I ended up, let's see, that was 1992. I did several more geographics all across the country. I lived in San Diego. I lived in Tennessee, I went back to New Orleans, you know, I went to New York. I mean, I was just all over the country, and I was just running. And I knew, you know, from being in treatment, from just those 28 days, that I couldn't outrun it. But it didn't stop me from trying. So I, you know, I put my poor dad through complete torment because he didn't know where I was for months at a time. So from the period of 1992 to 1998, there was a lot of in and out of jail, a lot of just nastiness on my part. You know, alcoholism at its worst, at its finest, whatever you want to say. In 1998, I had this period of time for about 4 years where I managed to control the drinking. You know, I wasn't doing anything illegal. I was coming home. I was paying bills. I went back to school. I finished school. I was working full time, but you know, the alcohol was always present and the quality of my life sucked. But I thought it was okay because I was comparing it to where I came from. And it fooled me into thinking that I could drink successfully, that I could drink like my peers. You know, I was in my, you know, late 20s, early 30s, and I was doing what everyone around me was doing. So it appeared okay. You know, never mind that I showed up for work every single day hungover, and they all thought it was funny. Never mind that I bought, you know, Pepto-Bismol BC powder and a bottle of vodka for everybody that was also hungover. You know, they thought that was great. You know, it was normal to me. You know, I was in the delusion. You know, I didn't know what was real and what wasn't real. And it wasn't until, and that went on, what did I say, until about 2003. And then I just couldn't do it anymore. I don't know what changed in my life that made me step over that line again. I'm an alcoholic. That's what it is. I just couldn't stop. The rest of, you know, my peers, they stopped, but not me. I'm not satisfied until I am, you know, passed out. And my drinking picked up to the point where I wasn't social anymore, you know. I was drinking alone. I was violent. Got in fights. I mean, I would just take you off a bar stool. And my dad was getting very sick. He had been diagnosed as a diabetic, and he had been diagnosed with diabetic neuropathy, which means that he didn't have any feeling in his feet, and he was falling a lot. You know, I'd call him on the phone and be like, "Hey, Daddy, how you doing?" He's like, "Oh, I fell. I was out at Regency Square Mall today. Oh, yeah, I fell. How you doing, Daddy? Oh, I was out at Shoney's. I fell. You know, oh, I was out in the backyard. I couldn't get up." You know, so I moved back into the house with him to be his caregiver. But it really just gave me permission to just be lazy, sloppy, and nasty. And I ended up going back to jail. And, you know, I left him alone. I left him alone in that house. And, I don't know what changed. I got to the point, I came home, and for 4 months, from June of 2005 to October of 2005, I white-knuckled it. Because I didn't want anything to do with AA. I didn't want anything to do with God. I didn't want anything to do with anybody. Because I still had ideas. I thought that if I just worked, took care of my dad, and came home every night, that everything was going to be okay. Well, it wasn't. I was so lonely. I was eaten up with loneliness. You know, I didn't know how to pray. I was raised in a church. I didn't know how to pray. I didn't know how to reach out and how to ask for help because I was taught that, you know, pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, you know, we can do it. We keep it in the family. Yeah. My dad didn't believe alcoholism was a disease. He believed that I could just be okay because he had drank while he was in his 20s and he had just stopped, called himself a teetotaler, and then he went to the ministry. So he couldn't understand why his daughter couldn't stop. So October 2005, I drank again. And I mean, I was drinking at my life, and I didn't want to be drunk anymore. I just wanted to be dead. I just wanted to be unconscious. And because of consequences of being in the penal system, I had a probation officer. And I woke up one morning, and she had called me, and she's like, "You know you're in trouble. You didn't come and see me." And I'm like, "I know." She said, "Why don't you come see me today?" I said, "Okay." So I packed a bag. I went to see her, and I said, "Take me back to jail, because I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to live life." I said, you know, 30-something years old. I said, "I don't have a job. I don't have a companion. I don't have the all-American trappings of a good life. You know, I can't do this." I said, "Just lock me up because I can do that. I know how to do that. I do well, you know, structure and the environment." And she looked me in the eye and she said, "Sherry, I'm not going to lock you up. I believe in you." I was like, "Why?" You know, I just broke down crying. I'm like, no, you don't know me. You don't know me. It was horrible. And she's like, "I'll tell you what. I'll put you in the jail for 5 days until we can find you a bed in a women's recovery house." And it was her belief in me when I didn't have any belief in myself. It changed something in me. It just, I felt that shift, you know, that God shift. You know, when she said that, I felt the presence of the universe. And so they did. I went to a women's recovery house, and I dedicated myself to AA. I got a sponsor. I worked steps. my sponsor, thank God, my first sponsor took me through the Big Book. You know, he's Big Book Thumper, day one, you know, cover to, you know, first 164 pages. But along about 9 months, you know, I'm doing the thing. I have a service position in my home group. You know, I'm fellowshipping. I'm doing all this stuff. I start looking around the rooms at the boys. And I said, I think I want a boyfriend. I think I'm ready. My sponsor said, are you sure about that? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I can do this. He's like, yeah, okay. Let's see how that works out for you, you know, because couldn't tell me what to do. Could only point out to me that this has been detrimental in many, 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 many cases over and over again because my focus was going to shift. You know, anything I start thinking about the most is my higher power. So, you know, and I had one all picked out, by the way. Yeah. And I can share his name. His name was Red. And we started flirting, and then we started dating, and then, you know, we started dating some more. I'll just put it that way. And, of course, I was just going to keep it light. We're just going to be friends with benefits. You know, fine, I got this. Whatever. Well, we fell in love. And I started missing meetings with my sponsor because Rhett and I would want to go to, you know, his property down there in Nelson County and hang out on the river. That's a little more important. Besides, I could talk to him. He was in the program. I could talk to him about, you know, recovery. We could have a meeting right there in the house, just the two of us. Yeah, I had a sponsor and a higher power and a meeting all in one. Yeah, it wasn't so good. But when AA is not in, when God and AA is not in the center of my life, you know, when I'm not in the middle of the circle and the triangle, this comes in because my disease is centered in my thinking. You know, and I start to think that it's a good idea not to go to so many meetings. You know, he also, Brett also has, I had a disabled daughter named Vivian. And Vivian's in her 20s now, but she has the mentality of about a three-year-old. And we were very close. You know, she would mimic. If you say things in a certain, if you hit a certain tone with your voice, you know, she would mimic you. And we would call it Vivi speak. And I was so devoted to her. So, I mean, what better reason to stay home than to take care of this beautiful child? You know, and so slowly, slowly, I let things go. And anything a relationship will do, it will put Miracle-Gro on your character defects. You know, so when, you know, Rhett would say, are you sure that skirt looks okay? I'd be like, what, am I too fat? What are you saying to me? I don't look good. You don't want me anymore? Oh, my God. You know, I mean, it was horrible. Just, I mean, I became the clingy, horrible girlfriend in the movie. And you know what that does to your spirituality? I mean, it wasn't about God anymore. It wasn't about AA anymore. It was all about me again. It was all about my needs, my wants. Who can I step on? Who can I manipulate? And I hadn't even picked up a drink. But then I did pick up a drink. I was supposed to pick up 1 year coin, and instead of my home group, I got up and picked up a white chip. Boy, that was a big hit. But let me tell you something. The friends that I and the fellowship that I developed in that year was awesome. Those people went above and beyond to try to help me. Now, they knew they couldn't carry the alcoholic. They could only carry the message, but I tell you what, they carried me for a while. And I just slapped him in the face. Shut the door. No, I'm not going to meet you. No, 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 no. And then, guess what happened? Brett decided it would be a good idea to drink with his girlfriend. So we drank together for a while. But see, he's not the type of alcoholic like me. You know, when I drink, I go to jail. Okay? When I drink, I commit crimes. When I drink, I hit people. You know, when I drink, I sleep in ditches. You know, he's the type of person that drinks, goes to bed, gets up, and goes to work. I couldn't figure that out, but I kept trying to do it, you know, and he kept trying to understand why I wasn't coming home at night. I was like, I didn't feel like it. I don't know. I was in a blackout. What do you want from me? So, make a very long story short, I went back to jail, and I left. Oh, meanwhile, my dad's, like, super sick. And I had, Rhett and my father got very close. You know, they bond, even though he was drinking, you know, he and my father bonded to try to save me. So he and my dad were very, very close. So when I went away this last time, you know, Rhett became my father's primary caregiver because we had been doing it together. And my dad ended up in a nursing home. And, you know, Rhett was the one that would go and see him and take him food. And it was through his cell phone that I was able to talk to my dad because, you know, you got to make those collect calls and that, yada, yada, yada. You know, communication is very difficult. And, but his disease is no different than my disease. It progressed. And my father ended up passing away in March of 2010. And again, God made it possible for me to make amends. And, he just wanted me to be okay. And I had to end the relationship with Rhett because by this point I had decided from the inside, you know, from inside behind the bars that I wanted to be sober and I wanted to work the steps and I wanted to help other people. I don't know what changed. I woke up one morning and I was like, I'm done, you know, because I was still, you know, using solid alcohol to change the way I felt. And to seek oblivion. I mean, that's just crazy. All the consequences, that was just insane that I wanted to do that. And again, God intervened and said, Sherry, you gotta do something different. Clearly you're not going to die. Clearly you're going to live. So you have a choice. And so I did. So I contacted those people that I was close with for a year, and they stepped up. I worked steps. I sponsored women. I went to AA. And, you know, I had a journey. I had a spiritual journey, you know, while I was incarcerated. And, you know, I had to separate from Rhett. We still talked on the phone, you know, and I still talked to Vivi on the phone, but I had to separate myself from him because he developed a hatred for the 12 steps. And I had no understanding, and we just had to separate. Didn't mean I didn't love him, and it didn't mean that he didn't love me to the best of his ability. So, after my dad died, I just really redoubled my efforts with AA. And, you know, and when I came home, you know, I got right in the middle. Again, circling the triangle. My same sponsor, you know, had worked with me. You know, we picked up right where we left off. I've recently gotten a new sponsor because mine moved to Portland, Oregon. And it just got to the point, I tried to do it long distance for about 2 years, and it was, I just felt like I was missing. I love my sponsorship family, you know, and I just really felt like I was missing that. You know, I never had a problem working the steps and seeing them in my life, you know, but I remember when Sam shared at Keystone and talked about a sudden spiritual experience. Mine was gradual, and it's still gradual. Probably the most profound spiritual experience I've had was, you know, on November 16th of 2013 when a very close friend of mine told me that Rhett was on life support as a direct result of his alcoholism. And he died on November 22nd. And, you know, during that time, my thinking was I could save him. It was getting close to Christmas. And I was feeling drawn back into that. You know, but God knows better. And I ended up, you know, rededicating my life to AA, starting to sponsor, you know, more women, becoming more available, letting work go, going from where I was living back into a women's recovery house because I needed the support. God made it possible for me to admit, I'm not Superwoman. I am not Super AA. I don't have all the answers, and I need some help right now because I was in a bad place in November and December, in a bad place. I didn't drink. But spiritually, it was frightening. And the only thing that kept me through was continuing to work the steps and knowing, you know, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I was insane in November. And I said, you know what? Either God is or he isn't. And you walked me through this far. You walked me through these last 40 years. Why can't you get me through this? And I just hung on and I kept going to meetings. you know, and I would make a decision every day to turn my life and my will over to the care of God. I pray the third step prayer every day, you know. I did another inventory. I just recently finished doing another inventory because throughout, you know, a lot of stuff, you know, when my dad died, I had a lot of resentments with some of the people that tried to keep me from his life because they thought that I was bad for him. And my father cut off his own nephew and said, no, I love my daughter. I will not cut her off. I don't care if she's an alcoholic. She's my daughter. And it cost him family, you know. I had to do a lot of writing. I had to do some stuff about that. You know, six, you know, I practice step six. You know, by working the first five steps, I become entirely ready. But I have to see, you know, how thorough am I today? You know, where is my foundation? Where are my cornerstones? How am I doing with that? You know, step seven, I pray the seven step prayer every day. My Creator, please remove me if you're blah, blah, blah. Willing. God, make me willing. Why aren't you removing me now? Oh, that's right. Not my time. It's God's time. I get so frustrated because I'll tell you what. I've got 5 minutes. I'll tell you. Work. I have this huge resentment, you know. Things going at work. I don't understand why God doesn't remove all these angry, fearful feelings from me. Because they are still serving some purpose, you know. They're still showing me how I don't want to be. You know, I can still look forward, you know, I still remain teachable and humble and say, oh, I still have all this stuff to deal with, you know, I still have to do this, I still have to call people, I still have to show up, I still have to, you know, keep commitments. I have to practice these principles in all my affairs, and that includes work, especially, you know, with the people around me. I try, you know, amends, there's some amends that I haven't made yet, you know. I ask God to, you know, hold me ready. And when it's time, it'll be time. You know, 10, 11, and 12. I am a huge believer in nothing so much helps me stay immune from drinking than working with another alcoholic. You know, I have to make myself available because all those people were available for me. You know, God always has time. You know, I'm not God, but He works through me, and He works through me to carry the message. Sponsoring people and meeting people is probably, I've shared this with Kathy, it's probably the single most the hardest thing I do because I'm an isolator. You know, I started out drink to be social and to fit in, and it came full circle, and I realized how much I like to stay in my own head and how my ideas sound brilliant when it's only me listening to them and, you know, and how much I really just enjoy my own company, you know, and how much I would rather just stay in the bed an extra hour instead of, you know, getting up and answering the phone. But, you know, that's not going to keep me sober staying in the bed an extra hour, you know. That's not going to help another alcoholic. And the gratitude I feel for AA, I can't even put it into words. I can't even put it into words. Every time I come into a meeting, I'm just amazed. I went to a meeting yesterday, and there was somebody there that had no time sober, you know, and the way they could vocalize their pain, that raw emotion after waking up just so sick, you know, reminded me, oh, my God, you know, I can give this person some hope. I can go over here to this girl and say, look, it's going to be okay. You know? It's going to be okay. You know? Here's my phone number. If you want to call me, call me. What's your phone number? I will call you. You know, I'm not the type of person that just says, call me. No, I get your phone number. I'm going to call you, too. So, I don't, you know, closing is always hard for me because at the end, there's, like, always all these things that I want to say. But, you know, a message of hope. I can't be grateful and pissed off at the same time. So I really try to be grateful. You know, when I'm agitated or when I'm doubtful, I just turn my thoughts to God, pray without ceasing. And I can't say it enough, helping another alcoholic. And that doesn't mean, I was taught, that doesn't mean you have to go on a 12-step call, Sherry. That means call your sponsor or, you know, call somebody and see if they need a ride. You know, helping an alcoholic doesn't have to entail all this other stuff. So, yeah. That's what I do. You know, and I love my life today. I love AA. And coming from me, who scorned it and shunned it and said, oh, they're a bunch of, you know, nerdy, boring, I can't even think of the other word that I used to use. You know what I'm talking about. You know how. You know what I'm saying? Oh, no. A cornball. Yeah. Bunch of corny. They always say the same thing. No, I love AA. I say the same thing all the time now, too. Imagine that. But I'm just full up. I'm full up. I am grateful that God and the universe saw fit to carry me. And I am really grateful that you all had me come and speak, and I'm done. Thank you.